Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself
and for those facing homelessness,
because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Previously on Mentally Yours.
I've been on pretty much every type of antidepressant there is, at least like the SSRIs. And there'd be various versions of side effects. So when I was on Paxil from like 8 to 12, I did put on a lot of weight there. And I think also again in college, I put on some weight. And then I had been off of meds when I was 21. And then like, I guess maybe almost a year and a half ago now, I was in a bad place and I just wasn't addressing, you know, I wasn't taking care of my mental health and I sort of needed some help. And I went on Zoloft.
It's Mentally Yours for Melon and Yvette. A podcast on your mental health you surely won't regret. It's mentally yours.
Okay, so before I say anything, I will say that like, I'm internet famous for being a poet, which means that I'm still less famous than any cat. You know what I mean? So I just need to keep it in perspective like that. But it's also, I've gotten used to it now, right? I first went viral about 5 years ago, and it was really overwhelming for the first couple of years because suddenly everybody knew I was very mentally ill. Where before, like, you know, I'd been at slams and I'd done poems in front of people, but obviously it was limited to like an actual audience of people that I could see and interact with. And now suddenly people were coming up to me randomly, like in coffee shops or on the street or like in airports, saying like, hey, I know you're totally crazy. Like, do you want to tell me about it? I'm like, no, I don't. I already did. I told you about it on the internet. Watch it there. Goodbye. So I'm used to it now, but it made me really agoraphobic for a couple of years.
So OCD, it's something you have, but also the name of probably your biggest poem.
Yeah.
The one that kind of made you internet famous, like you say. Would you mind telling us a bit about when you were first diagnosed, how it affects you now, and basically how you're doing right now?
Sure. I was first diagnosed when I was 11 years old. I'd always been a weird, rigid child. You know, I was very particular about things, but it got to a point where I'm starting to have very obvious tics. You know, I had a head tick and was doing a lot of hand washing, and my mom was like, we got to get this kid checked out. So, you know, she took me to a psychiatrist who later diagnosed me with bipolar disorder, interestingly. But yeah, the psychiatrist was like, yep, you have OCD, shows up, you know, normally between about 10 and 11, enjoy yourself. And so I just went to a ton of therapy throughout my teenage years, most of which has not, I wouldn't say gotten rid of, but given me the tools to handle a lot of my tics. Like, I still have the obsessions and the desire to do all that stuff, but I have the coping mechanisms, and I've done so much EMDR that I can normally resist doing them, which makes it easier to not do them later. You know, I still have a head tick, and I'll still have to wash my hands a lot whenever I'm really stressed or something like that. But most of the time, yeah, I've just done so much work on it that it doesn't take up hours of my day anymore.
What's EMDR?
I forget what it stands for. but it's a type of therapy. It's effectively guided meditation. So effectively, we'll be sitting in therapy and the therapist will ask me, okay, picture a triggering event. You know, it's whether it's like touching garbage, then you got to wash your hand 5 times or whatever it is. And then she'll have me like just keep that image, set it aside for a second, and then have me picture literally just a safe place. For me, weirdly, it's actually like this one time I was traveling in around England with my family, and we were in the Lake District. And we were like on this boat, and it was raining slightly, and there were mountains around me, and so like we did this exercise that allows me to jump right to that safe place and effectively jump into a meditative place that allows me to stop myself from ticking. So yeah, it's just guided meditation designed to give you a way to reset your own brain. I wish I knew what it stood for. Should have come in prepared with that, and I didn't. So
you mentioned also before that now people kind of come up to you straight off the bat and say, you know, oh yeah, mental health guy, talk to me about mental illness.
Yeah.
how do you deal with that? Do you have like a set response now, or do you just kind of do it by ear?
I used to have set responses. I used to have just particular things I said, but it started to feel really disingenuous when I was just saying the exact same thing to everybody, because it felt like I was just having a fear response and I wasn't actually like listening to or interacting with anyone. So what I've really started doing is somebody will just say like, your work really related to me. And I'm like, oh, cool. What's going on with you? And then I just let them talk, you know? And I think it's been way more effective for me to just listen to people's stories with mental health and just let them tell me why they related to the work than me just coming out and saying like, this is exactly what I think you should do. Goodbye. You know?
How do you make sure you look after yourself when you're listening to those stories? Because I think both of us written about mental health. Sure. And when you do that publicly, people tend to tell you some, it can be distressing right. stuff. How do you make sure that doesn't weigh too heavily on you?
Well, I'd be interested in asking y'all the same question. Like, how do you run a podcast and talk specifically about it all the time? And like, I feel like it's probably the same. You know, I effectively think of like me being on stage, me being at work, like that's Neil Hilborn. Mm-hmm. And then me every day, I'm just Neil, right? And Neil Hilborn's great at dealing with people's stuff. He's really able to listen to people and be really empathetic, but not go too far into their emotions with them and mm-hmm. things like that. And Neil would totally lose his mind if he had to do that every day. You yeah. know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I just found the part of me that can do that. And maybe it's unhealthy compartmentalization, but I think it hasn't hurt me yet. So we'll see in 10 years. But
I think if it works, keep doing
cool,
it.
Cool, yeah. cool, great. Excellent. Awesome. I mean, like, what do y'all do to decompress after talking about mental health every
I have
day?
To go home and just do something completely unrelated.
Okay.
Diffuse completely. Like after this, I can't go, because usually we do it in the evening. I can't go straight to bed after that because I will just be like thinking stress stuff, etc. Just taking breaks a lot of the time.
Cool.
That's really interesting that you recognize that you have to do that.
Oh yeah, massively.
Because like it's weird. I can definitely relate to what you said about sort of like being like performance Neil and normal Neil, because I love doing this podcast and I love writing about mental health stuff, but it is definitely like there's, you know, like journalist Yvette, and then there's just me.
Sure.
So it is two different things. And I've talked about this before on the podcast, the way that like I'll talk about all different kinds of stuff because I have bipolar disorder and I'll like go on about that here. And yeah, again, sort of talk to readers about that stuff. But then actually in my private life, a lot of the times I don't have those conversations with friends or boyfriends, or whatever, like until much later on, which sure. is bizarre when you think about the fact that I'm literally doing this every week.
I know, man.
It is a bit odd, but so I suppose it is having that kind of divide, like you say. Yeah. That's something that I was going to ask you though as well, because you've written sort of beautiful, sort of intense things about OCD, bipolar disorder. How do you sort of prepare to go on stage to talk about those things? Do you have kind of a system in place? Like how does it even work?
Well, part of it is that like the set, I've done the set so many times that I know I might not know exactly the specific words I'm going to say, but I know how the set goes and I know when I'm going to talk about what. And it's very practiced, mm-hmm. you know, so that feels nice. Like I just get on stage and I'm like, no, I can just hit like I can just hit play on these poems. Right. And I've done them so much that I don't have to think about them anymore. They just come out of my face. And, you know, I'll do unscripted bits of banter where I'm talking to the audience or telling a story or whatever. But I know that anytime I'm floundering in a bit, I can just be like, okay, next poem. and so it's all, that's also practice that it's not really hard for me to do. And really, like, it's fun, man. I feel like I'm not good at many things, but, and I don't really experience joy that often, but that sort of hour that I'm on stage, I feel super competent and really happy for one of the only times in my life, you know? So I get excited about it, man. Like, mm-hmm. I'm hanging out in the green room listening to, so normally, like, whatever city I'm in, I just like to listen to a band that's from there. And so UK, it's been great because y'all have a lot of really good bands. Except in Nottingham, that was terrible. But sorry, Nottingham.
We're gonna get complaints.
Yeah, I told them that on stage, so I've already gotten a lot of complaints.
One of the things you mentioned in your TED talk is that because you gave a TED talk, which was obviously on YouTube as well, yes. about OCD and sort of the performance side of things, is that your family's always been very open and supportive about mental health issues. Is that across the board, or is that just like your mom? Or
it's my mom and certain aspects of my mom's family, and I feel fine putting my family's business out there because they don't pay attention to things I do. So yeah, it feels like my most of the mental health issues come from my dad's side of the family. Like my mom's side of the family has some stuff, but it's not the stuff that I have. And my dad's side of the family is not at all interested in talking about it. Like, it was my aunt, for instance, who I never met, she died before I was born. She, hearing stories about her, she was very clearly bipolar, right? And she very clearly killed herself. But they just say, oh, she died young. And I'm like, come on, guys. Like, can we talk about this even a little bit? Like, my dad's got really severe OCD. It makes him a very intense workaholic. And really led to like our family falling apart, but because he was not interested in talking about it or going to therapy at all. So yeah, that whole side of the family is very, very Germanic and repressed. So yeah, basically, if I talk about my mental health issues, it's really I'm talking to my mom and my brother and a few aunts and uncles who also get it, you know. But yeah, everybody on my dad's side of the family just don't speak to him. Although, that's not totally fair. His sister, Marilyn, and her whole family they're really excellent. And they've come to a lot of my shows. I don't need to be a total jerk. I sometimes forget that I'm related to them through that particular part. Anyway.
I was going to say, though, yeah, since becoming sort of famous from your poetry, have you had different elements of your family sort of get in touch and then suddenly say, oh, actually, I've got this thing, or my son's got this thing, or...
Yeah, man.
I found that weirdy, which was nice.
Really?
Yeah, it was really nice. Because like one of not like a really distant relative, but like a relative that I didn't realize would want to talk about this, just Facebook DM'd me. And that was really nice.
Yeah.
Because my family don't really talk about it, which again is weird that I talk about it all the time, but we never talk about it when I'm at home. Like right, never.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, because that dynamic's already in place, mm-hmm. you know, and you develop into a person that talks about mental health, but not with them. So yeah, totally. It's really opened up a lot of conversations with, because I mean, I always talk to my mom and brother about it because we're all totally crazy people and we're all going to therapy. And we were a support system for each other. But yeah, but for my more extended family, like after, you know, the people that I'd just seen at holidays and had nice conversations with, but about like the turkey, you know, but it definitely after OCD blew up and people realized that like I talk about my feelings professionally, you know, it really, the next time I saw a lot of extended family, we actually sat down and they're like, hey, you know, your grandfather had blah, blah, blah. And your aunt, you know, and it really helped us talk more about our family history generally. So
it's cool when your work actually pushes other people to open up as well.
Yeah.
It must be really cool.
Yeah,
experience.
It's been fun. Yeah. A little terrifying, mostly fun.
Can we get a bit geeky? And can you tell us a bit about the process of sort of creating one of your poems?
Sure. Yes, I love craft. I'll talk boring technical stuff.
And then
every
are you all right to do us a poem?
Yeah, totally.
Is that the technical term? Do us a poem.
Yeah, yeah. I normally just say do a poem, man. I don't know. Some people say read, some people say, I don't know, man. I'll just do poems.
Slam us. No, that sounds terrible, doesn't it? Slam me a poem. Yeah. Especially in it. No, can I say it again? It sounds terrible in my accent. Slam me a poem.
I'll leave. So I feel like I have two distinct processes. The first one is the one you always hope for, right? I just have like that sort of that lightning bolt moment of inspiration where normally I'm doing something else. You know, I'm driving or doing dishes or in the shower on my bike or whatever. And then my brain will be like, hey, here are a couple lines. You have to write these lines. You got to write them right now. And that's great. You know, that just happens. The poem just kind of falls out wherever I am, you know, pulled over on the side of the road or sitting wet and naked on my bathroom floor, really whatever it is, right? But you can't depend on those. Those just happen whenever they happen. So since I became a professional writer and started actually having to reliably produce new work, I just – when I'm not on tour, I just don't write things because it's just hard and I'm not good at it. But when I'm at home, I just go – I go to the coffee shop every day. Actually, so my wife has an office job, and so I just wake up with her and I drive her to work, and then suddenly I've tricked myself into being in clothes and out in the world. So I'm like, all right, cool. I'll just go to the coffee shop and I write till I get too anxious or agoraphobic, and then I go home, and then I make myself some lunch because it's normally around 12:30, and then I just write at home till I go pick her up from work, you know? So for me, like the more common process is I just – I have to basically show up and bang my head against my notebook or computer screen until something comes out. Most of it's going to be bad. 95% of the poems are terrible, but I just got to keep writing them because some of them are going to end up being good. So yeah.
I'm glad you said that because I think creative people don't really mention like, you just have to sit there and just write or do whatever and hope something sticks.
Yeah, dude.
Yeah, one of my favorite things about Philip Larkin, the famous poet, is that he... Yeah, I went to Hull University.
Really?
So, yeah, it's knowing that he made his girlfriend... Well, when he died, he sort of told his girlfriend that she had to burn all his terrible work because he'd kept it all, but he was just like, nobody's going to see this. So you have to burn it all.
Yeah.
So there's like, so the idea that he had these incredible poems, which obviously he did, but you also had this huge body of work, which he was just like, that's not good enough. That's not good enough. That's not good enough.
Right. And, so, yeah. And you have to wonder, I always wonder what people's capacity for self-editing is. I have to believe like Philip Larkin stuff is really, really linguistically precise. So I've got to believe that he kind of knew when something was going to work and when it wasn't. But often I have a lot of stuff. Not to put myself on the same level as Philip Larkin even a little bit, but often I feel like I have poems that I think are garbage and then somebody comes up to me and they're like, Neil, this mostly is terrible, but these four lines are salvageable. So like rewrite it around this when I would have just thrown out the whole thing, you know, so.
Who do you have that sort of helps you with that? Is that your wife? Is that your agent?
It's my wife and a couple of my friends who are also my publisher. It's weird that happened. We never thought this was going to be a thing, you know? when Button Poetry first started and they were just taking videos of spoken word poems because there was no good media of it at the time. And then suddenly it blew up and YouTube gave them a bunch of money and now they're a publisher and they're my publisher. Anyway, but before any of that happened, we wrote together and we edited together all the time. So I just get together with my friend Sam every couple weeks and I'm like, hey, this is everything I've written. Is there anything good here? And Sam's like, most of this is bad. These lines are good. This poem's gold. Keep this. Keep these four lines and rewrite them, you know? So you need people who just like brutally, honestly edit you, who you're then not hurt because of those brutal edits, you know?
How easy do you find it to share and have edited things that are very personal and emotional?
It's terrifying.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I hate it. But it's got to happen, you know? And one of my favorite feeling as a writer is like being on the sixth or seventh draft of a piece. You've been beating your head against it for a really long time. You've literally just like written like pages and pages of stuff and just deleted it because it's garbage. Because you just have to write to the point where you get it. But that first time that it clicks, right, where it's like literally it's like, this is a terrible metaphor, Neil. But it's not even that like you're trying to find the last piece of a puzzle. It's that piece of a puzzle has been like lost under the damn couch. And you finally look under there for something else. And this puzzle has been like, you've been working on it for 2 months. And you're like, the cat stole it. Bam, puzzle, done. That's like that moment feels really revelatory. And that's when I feel like most powerful as a creator and author. I'm like, yeah, I can do anything. Anyway, sorry, terrible metaphor, but I'm a writer.
Thanks.
In terms of your own kind of mental health generally, how do you find the process of touring? Because you mentioned like being on stage, that's like golden, that's the joy, which is great. But how do you find the bit between, which must be quite boring, you know, sat in a bus?
I like it, man. It's it's terrible and I love it. Because I like having goals, you know, like when I'm just sitting at home and my job is right, that all feels very vague and nebulous. But when I'm on the road, it's all easy. You know, I'm like, no, what I'm doing today is driving to Chicago, and it's 6 hours to Chicago. So that's what I do today. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I only have an hour. So I'm just going to go to the venue and check in, and then I'm going to sound check, and then I'm going to do that. So it's always very obvious what the next thing is. Mm-hmm. I'm great with structure. If I don't have time to be anxious, then I'm just not going to be anxious, you know? So yeah, I mean, I'm going to go home after we're done here. We're going to be here for a month total, and I'm going to go home and not move for about 3 days, because yeah, my body's going to hurt and I'm going to like descend into a deep black depression. But, that itself is also sort of fun because I feel like I earned it in a certain way, where normally when I'm really down, I'm so critical of myself. I'm like, why are you sad? Why aren't you moving? Like you don't deserve this, you know? And so, but because I feel like because I've been working for a month, I feel like I can tell the sad part of my brain, like, nah, dude, like we were doing stuff. Shut up, eat the Chinese food, you know?
I'm sort of struck dumb by a bit by that, because you said a lot there. I mean, you kind of said, so you really think you will be depressed after this?
Absolutely.
Okay. That's interesting.
I've been pretty manic the whole time we've been here. Not the whole time. It kicked in about 4 days into the tour. And I was super, super low the few weeks before we came here. I didn't know if I'd be able to do this tour. But yeah, it kicked in. Where were we? Birmingham, I think. And then, yeah, I've been feeling like super invincible and I can do anything. And I know in my head, I'm like, I know this is going to last till... Actually, it'll probably keep going. I don't know. Anyway, who knows? It's hard to predict that. But yeah, but I can feel it. I can feel it coming on that, like, after I don't have this fun thing that I love doing, I'm just going to fall on the couch and not move, you know? So
do you have, like, what are the support systems you have in place for when that kind of comes? Because I totally relate to that because, you know, I'm not going to say I'm the same, but I mean, I do also have bipolar disorder.
Yeah, yeah.
So like, I understand that, you know, it goes up and down. I'm doing this thing with my hand. No one can see it as a podcast.
this is a little wave.
I'm doing nice, like, an up and wave. Down. Yeah. So yeah, what are the kind of support systems you have? I mean, obviously you have your wife.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, she's my main support system aside from my therapist, who I love very much.
But not in the same way.
No, I did fall in love with a therapist once. And she definitely fired me. So, yeah. I mean, it was mutual fire. I don't know. Like, I showed up to a therapy session one time with like a bunch of my poems that I wanted to see I think the flimsy reason was I was like, I want you to understand me better. But really, I was trying to like make her love me because I thought I was good at writing poems. And then I like pulled them out of my bag and I was like, oh no, I think I'm in love with you. We gotta go. So yeah, that happened. But no. I'm not in love with this therapist like this. So, yeah, so it's, so there's my wife who's obligated to talk to me. And then there's my therapist who's financially obligated to talk to me. And then, I have two rabbits that I love very much. And we just hang out and I let them destroy things in my house. So that's, yeah, I feel like that's really everything I need. You know, I have friends that I like a lot, but, I feel like the people that I really rely on is that group of people, and I feel really happy with that, you know.
Also, it sounds like you've really learned to like be very aware of your own moods and symptoms and kind of self-manage. How do you get to that point?
I've been writing about it professionally for a long time. I think literally it's just I've just been critically analyzing my own mental health state and my own feelings for so long that it just, I think that's bled out where I've been editing poems about my mental health issues and thinking critically about the way I express them. So it's been really easy to take a step back and use the same editing brain to think about what's going on in my Neil emotional brain.
Do you think it's been helpful then?
Absolutely, it has. Yeah. Sometimes it can get a little bit weird because I compartmentalize too much, but that's why I have therapists and a wife who gets me, you know, because they can be like, hey, Neil, you're pushing stuff too far away. You got to actually deal with this and not just analyze it. Mm-hmm. So
do you mind me asking about meds? Like, have you taken meds? Are you on meds?
I'm not on meds right now. I have been in the past. And for me, meds have always been a thing that I've just used to reset almost. Like I've been on meds in times in my life when I was just losing it too hard and couldn't actually get things done. Yeah, I think they're great. And I think that they're an amazing tool. And I'm just like, I don't super need them right now because I feel like I have the tools to handle what's going on right now. But yeah, it's it's always right there. I know, like, if I start losing it too much, I'm on meds immediately. So yeah, man.
It's really interesting to sort of hear that kind of perspective as well, because I think a lot of people, like, who maybe don't have mental health issues think, you know, like, you're either on them or you're not on them, or, you know, like, or if you have a condition and you're not on them, that must be like, oh my god,
right,
what the hell's going on?
Yeah. I know a few people though that use it kind of like, okay, things are good for now, but if it goes through a dip, I can go back on them, it's fine. And that's quite a nice, healthy way to think about it.
I mean, I can especially feel like I my swings go way more toward depression than they do toward mania. And so, like, but I can feel like I'm just like, I just pay attention to the sort of level of depression. And like, if it hits more than about like a 70, 75%, that's when I'm like, give me the lithium, do it now. But even in super dark moments, I can at least sort of self-analyze and be like, okay, am I actually going to kill myself or am I just thinking about it? You know? And I feel like I've got the people that I can tell, hey, I'm not okay, call a psychiatrist right now, you know? So yeah, it's gotten scary a couple times, but that's what meds are for, you know?
Can I ask, how did you, like, find poetry and get into it? Because it's quite a, like, niche thing.
Sure. I've been writing poetry ever since I was a little kid. I think I wrote my first poem when I was like 8 or something. It was terrible. It was about the moon, whatever. But I started doing spoken word in college. I was probably about 19 as my sophomore year. And the guy who's now my friend, at the time I hated him, but his name is Dylan Garrity. He's one of my best friends and he was a jerk back then. But I showed up to a meeting in my literary magazine and there was a spoken word poem. He wanted the workshop. And so he just like stood up in this literally meeting room and just like started shouting this like terrible poem. It was so bad. but it was a mind blowing moment because I didn't realize you could yell and do poetry at the same time. So I was like, dude, what are you doing? And he was like, yeah, it's spoken word. It's slam poetry. You ever been to a poetry slam? I was like, no, what is that? Cause I grew up in Houston, Texas, man. We didn't have, it turns out we had art, but I didn't know at the time. I'm from the suburbs where nothing happens. So, but yeah, Dylan took me to some poetry slams in Minneapolis where we lived. And it just seemed fun. You know, I never thought like this is going to be my career, but it just seemed like an interesting way to think about poems and a new style, a new genre to go after. So I just started writing poems and competing. And then
was there also an element of, well, you know, he's got off and done this terrible poem and I can definitely do better than that.
Sure. And then my first poems that I wrote were worse. So, man, I was so bad. It's weird. It feels like most people, when they get into spoken word, they're bad for about a year and a half. And I was bad for like 3 years. I sucked, dude. Like, I found recently some videos of those like really early poems and I deleted them, man. I was like, nobody can know. Like, this isn't even worth preserving for like a historical record. This sucks and I hate it. So, I thought, I was like, I can totally do better. Cause it's literally like poetry slams are competitive poetry, right? Which is just, it's an insane concept. I can't believe that it's real, but really it's just a way to trick people into listening to poems. You know, you turn it into a game, you say somebody can win something and then suddenly there's stakes, you know, but yeah, man, I was bad.
Did you start out writing about mental health stuff or?
No.
Yeah. When did it change?
It's probably OCD, man. Everything else that I wrote was either like a funny poem that had hints about like mental illnesses and things, but it wasn't, the narrative wasn't explicitly about mental health. I wrote a bunch of persona pieces where I was doing characters that weren't me. But yeah, I mean, I guess OCD first came out, you know, weirdly, OCD was a funny poem when I first wrote it. It went through about 20 drafts. But the original thing, I was just hanging out with some friends talking about, I was like, oh, I have OCD and asthma. Haha, isn't that funny? And they were like, yeah, dude, write a poem. So the first draft of OCD was, it was a fabricated breakup letter to a woman who broke up with me because, what was the line? It was a quote, like, I'm crazy and my lungs don't work. Right. And it was just a bunch of jokes about the intersection of OCD and asthma. Like, it was so stupid. But as it went through an editing process and I brought it to my team and I brought it to my friends, we just edited it as the editing gradually happened. Like, some of the jokes fell out. The asthma almost totally fell out, although weirdly there are still remnants of it where there are lines like, I can't breathe because he only kisses her once and stuff about like, oh God, the line where it's like, she can run away from this and I just can't, like, because originally there were a whole bunch of jokes about like jogging and how she liked jogging and I couldn't do it. So man, it's weird, like, looking back at it now that like some of these lines that really hit people are like lines that were originally stupid jokes, right? So I think literally that process of editing it and going through like 20 drafts was me finally coming to terms with doing some actual confessional poetry and really talking about what I was going through. Weird. I hadn't actually thought about that. Cool. All right. That's a weird story I just told about myself. So yeah.
How did it feel when you got to that point? Like, did it feel like, wow, I should have been doing this the whole time? Did it feel scary?
Awkward? Yeah, it was terrifying.
Yeah.
The first time I really put that poem out in the world, I wrote it. So you can have poetry teams and they're gigantic poetry tournaments, which is – I can't believe – when I think about it outside of myself, it seems crazy. But I was on a team from my college. We were going to the College National Poetry Slam, and it was like my senior year in college. I was about to graduate, and I wrote it for that competition basically. And – yeah, everything else that I'd done before was like funny or loud or weird. And that whole competition was super intense, personal narrative, confessional stuff, the whole tournament. And that's when it really clicked for me that's what I was like supposed to be writing. You know, I still write a lot of funny poems. I still really enjoy humor. But yeah, it seems like that's when it clicked with me that my work that audiences connect with most is the stuff that's just honest personal narrative.
What's it like having people get your words tattooed on them? Because it seems to happen a lot.
Is that a big thing?
Honestly, man. I've considered it, but I can't ever settle on fonts, which is why I don't get words.
Sure. Yeah.
Never get word tattoos.
For me, it's all pictures. I have like a little bit of writing, but it's all like incidental to the tattoo, and so it was obvious immediately what the font was supposed to be and things like that. I mean, a lot of people asked to get it in my handwriting, and I'm like, guys, my handwriting is terrible. Like, don't you, like, haven't you seen any of it? It's really bad. You also say like, hey, tattoo artists hate when you do this. I want you to know. Because like my tour manager Mark, he used to be a tattooer, and he's like, dude, just like tell him to get a real font. I'm like, I know, I try, but they want it in my handwriting. So yeah, but like ultimately, people can get whatever tattoos they want, and I can shut up, you know. But that's been another thing that I just put on Neil Hilborn. Like, Neil Hilborn can deal with the fact that he wrote something that people want to get a tattoo of, and Neil would get super overwhelmed if he ever thought about it too much.
Do you have tattoos then?
Yeah. I got a bunch of them.
So have you got any of your own lines tattooed on you? I mean, why not?
Sure. I don't know, man. I don't like myself that much.
No, I was joking. Although I think that would be I think that would be quite funny.
You're right.
Have a whole poem like around your arm.
Yeah, I think I have considered often. There are a couple like really old poems that are just sort of in jokes with my friends because they're the only, you know, there were no videos. They're the only like. Only maybe 20 people ever saw them, but there's some like really funny lines that we still quote at each other. So I might do something like that, but I wouldn't get like
serious one. Because I feel like it's too risky. Like writers hate their work a year after writing.
Oh yeah, that's true actually. Yeah, so you maybe like 5 years time, we just be, oh my God, I'm really, you know, sick to death of that one.
I mean, I got a bunch of terrible tattoos. So like I'm not worried about that. I have bad taste in tattoos, but I have good taste in writing. So I'd probably just hate anything I wrote.
Are the lines that people get most often lines that you kind of knew would resonate when you wrote them?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. It's, I don't often have that moment when I'm writing, like, oh, I nailed it on this one. Yeah. Right. But I think the line that people get the most often is the last line of my poem, The Future, or the line specifically, I saw the future. And the line goes, I saw the future, comma, I did, comma, and in it I was alive. And sometimes they'll elide the I did, but anyway, whatever, I don't care. Editing's great. Cool. So, I would say that's the most common one. And that's the one where like when I was writing the poem, it's the last line. It's always been the last line of the piece from the very first draft. So yeah, when I wrote it, I just like, I literally threw my pen across the room. I was like, yeah, I did it. Yeah. So that one, I nailed it on that one. Man.
I think I expected that. It's a good line.
Yeah, man. I've been hearing that the world is ending. I've heard it so much these days that I can either completely ignore it or never leave my house again. That is, if I actually left my house for things that don't directly enable me to keep my house. See, I've been thinking about driving nowhere. I've been thinking about becoming a box inside a locked room, inside a dark house at the dark end of the street. I want to go away until I'm gone. It takes so much less energy to not exist than it does to exist and get burned. I've been burned so much I'm not me anymore. I'm a stupid puppet version of me. I got strings that lead to nowhere. Nothing is pulling on me. I wish someone would drag my hand out of hiding and sign my name on the dotted line. There are days when I can't find the sun, even though it's right outside my goddamn window. When getting out of bed feels like the key in the doomsday machine. So on those days, this is what I tell myself. Whatever you're feeling right now, there's a mathematical certainty that someone else is feeling that exact thing. This is not to say you aren't special. This is to say, thank God you aren't special. I too have kissed no one goodnight. I've launched myself from tall places and hoped no one would catch me. I've ended relationships because suddenly I was also exposed, but isolation is not safety, it's death. Even no one knows you're alive, you aren't. If a tree falls in the forest and no one's around to hear it, it does make a sound, but then that sound is gone. I'm not saying you'll find the meaning of life in other people. I'm saying other people are the life to which you provide the meaning. See, we're wrong when we say, I think, therefore I am. The more we say it, the more it sounds like, I think, therefore I will be. You can't think your way into a full table. You can't think and make walls and a roof appear around you. I have thought and thought myself into corners made of words and nightmares. And what has it gotten me but more thoughts? A currency that only buys more currency. So please, if you want to continue existing, do something. Learn to make clouds using only your breath. Build a house, even if every wall leans to the left. Love it anyway, just like a season, just like a child. Love how you hate yourself sometimes, because at least there's still something to hate. I know how easy it can be to think and keep thinking until you are the last person left on Earth, until the entire world becomes no larger than the space between your bed and the light switch. But I hear the world's ending soon. When we go, and we're all going to go, I will be part of it.
Thank you.
Yeah, man. Totally. Thank you. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Of course, man. Thank you.
Some distance goodbye for mentally yours. So go away, enjoy your day, get on with all your chores from mentally yours. Mentally yours.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns. Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.